Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. I hope you are all having a great holiday week. And as a little treat for the very end of the year, we are resharing one of my absolute favorite episodes from 2023 with a true dream guest for this podcast, the one and only Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Julia and I spoke back in May around the release of her latest collaboration with filmmaker Nicole Holofcener, You Hurt My Feelings, which, if it were up to me, would be getting way more awards buzz right now than it is. I mean, Julia is really phenomenal in this movie, but of course, she has been great in pretty much everything she's ever done. And we got to talk about so much of it in this conversation, from getting her start on SNL, to the early days of Seinfeld, to the role of her lifetime as Vice President Selina Meyer on Veep. Just for fun, let's listen to one of my favorite scenes from that show, featuring another former Last Laugh guest, Tony Hale, as her right-hand man, Gary Walsh.
Do you pray?
A lot.
What do you pray for?
You know. You maybe want to try it?
Sure. You know, what the hell? We're here, right?
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
God,
It's me, Selina.
Oh, Lord God, okay, it's me, Selina. Grant me wisdom and strength.
Give us your comforting presence.
I've got it now. Okay. I've got it. Yep. Lord God, please ease my mother's pain and suffering.
Yes, Lord.
Ease
yes.
her passing. Mm-hmm. Ease it all. Yes. Ease it down the... Lord... Let her daughter, thy humble servant, be the first woman elected president of the United States. Please, this is so much to bear.
Oh, it is, Lord, it is.
Hear my prayer.
Hear her prayer.
Lift me up. Actually lift me up because heel is stuck in this thing. Yeah, I got it.
Before we get into the interview, I want to thank all of you for listening this year, especially everyone who's stuck with the show through a longer-than-expected paternity leave for me. And to all of the new listeners who are just discovering this podcast now, we have done over 220 episodes over the past 4.5 years, so I encourage you to check some of those out as well. I know that I and every other podcast host is constantly asking you to do this, but if during these last few days of the year, you could take a moment to leave us a rating and review on Apple or Spotify, it would mean the world to me. I love hearing from listeners, and it really does help other people find the show as well. Okay, that's it. We will be back next week with a very exciting new episode that you are not going to want to miss. But for now, here's me with the great Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Thank you for doing this, you know, before we get to the movie, I really just have to tell you that I have been absolutely loving your podcast.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate that very much.
Yeah, I'm not surprised, but you are such a natural at it. And it's just, I think it's been so great. So what made you want to do that?
Well, I'll tell you exactly. I was, I'm eating a piece of chocolate. I watched the Jane Fonda documentary. And I was so, I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't, no.
Well, you should watch it
because
you would be.
Yeah,
it's captivating. And I was just so struck by like, how come we're never hearing from these older ladies? We just never hear from them. I mean, we just don't. And that's how it began. And I just thought, I want to hear from these women. You know, I really do. I really want to hear how they've done it. And so that's how it was born.
It's called Wiser Than Me, and I was curious what the exact criteria is for you. How do you choose who you want to talk to?
So the criteria are just, frankly, women I want to hear from. So it's just like my own curiosity. And we sort of are trying to make it to be roughly around 70 and above.
Roughly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really great. And but yeah, I want to get into the movie. You Hurt My Feelings. This is your second film with Nicole Holofcener after Enough Said, which I loved as well. I think they're both really fantastic films.
Thank you.
Do you feel like, you know, between that movie and this movie, does her writing allow you to show a different side of yourself, a different skill set as an actor than you think you have in other roles?
Yes, I believe so. Because she's so, as a writer, she so brilliantly straddles the very believable world of drama and comedy in real life and how they intertwine with one another. And that is a very appealing to me. And it's something I like. I like that tone.
Yeah,
it
definitely.
Really, it's the kind of thing I like to see in when I go to the movies. And so the opportunity to do that, you know, It's kind of a small sort of a performance, really.
Yeah, there's such a specificity to her work that I love, where there's just these moments in the film that I feel like just would not be in other movies, because it's like, there are these moments that don't necessarily drive the plot forward, but they just tell you something about the characters or they tell you something about this world. And I think those moments are really great.
Yeah, and it's all very choice and very intentional on her part, you know? It's very curated. These moments are very curated.
It has such a great premise. You know, your character is a writer who overhears her husband admitting that he doesn't like her new book.
I mean, if I say even the slightest thing, she falls apart.
I thought that you liked her writing.
I do, generally, but I don't like this new book.
And this is a memoir?
No. She's written a novel. It's fiction. It's kind of a mystery. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it is.
You should go.
I just feel stuck, and I don't know what to do. Does that make sense?
I don't know.
Oh, shit, man.
Can you say anything?
No, I can't. I can't. I could have, maybe should have, you know, like second, third, 20th read.
20th read?
Yeah, yeah. Draft after draft after draft. She was asking for notes, and I didn't know how to, and now it feels too late.
And it's no good.
Not to me.
Just made me think about how people, you know, in general, but people in Hollywood tend to be overly complimentary about everything. And, you know, if you have a movie premiere, no one's going to tell you it's bad at the movie premiere.
No.
It's kind of shocking to hear someone in your own life say that they didn't like something. Did you have any experience like that to draw on for what that was like for your character in the film?
Well, not in the sense that, not with my spouse, but I could certainly imagine it. And I could fantasize what it would be like. And I can tell you that just even thinking about it makes my skin crawl.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Are you able to sympathize or empathize with both sides of this, you know, dispute, this marriage in the film, where you can sort of understand where the husband is coming from as well as your own character?
Yes. Oh, yeah. They're no bad guys. I mean, everybody's just making some mistakes. maybe multiple mistakes. These are not badly intentioned people. But the character I play is very needy and without an enormous amount of confidence.
Oh, my God. Oh my. Wait, Beth.
Oh, my God.
I think they were talking about something else.
Oh, I can't believe this.
No, I mean, maybe we misheard.
And then I'm going to be sick.
Oh, no, you are?
Yeah, I think I'm going to throw up.
Right there. It's a oh, God, right here?
Oh, God. No, I don't think I can. I can't.
He loves you more than life itself.
What does that have to do with anything
I'm
here?
I'm saying that he doesn't love your book, okay? He doesn't love your book. I mean, who cares?
Do you understand? I've been working on this book for 2 years,
uh-huh.
Right? I've given him like a million drafts to read. And every time he reads it, every single time he tells me how much he loves it. Every single time.
Because he just doesn't, like, you know, get it or whatever.
And now my hands have gone numb.
Yeah,
for real.
Okay, can you take a deep breath?
I am breathing, Sarah.
All right. Would you just, you're going to talk to him.
Well, that's a joke. I am never going to be able to look him in the face ever again. Okay, that's over.
How do you feel like you handle criticism now versus earlier in your career? Does it hit you very differently now than it did when you were starting out?
I think so. I think I'm a little more confident now that I'm older, but it's nicer to get a compliment than it is a criticism, you know?
Well, it might also be true that you haven't gotten much negative criticism in this later part of your career just because your work has been so incredible and the projects that you've worked on. So that might be a factor too, right? I mean, that it maybe has been a while since you've even heard negative criticism.
No, I've heard negative criticism. But somehow there's always a little sting, but maybe the sting doesn't last as long.
Yeah, I remember you talking about in some other interviews and other platforms that, you know, talking about getting bad reviews for SNL when you were starting out, both,
yes,
you know, in print and even from people in your own life.
Yes. Was
that a particularly, you know, difficult situation for you? Because you were so young, you were, I think, 21, right, when you started on that show?
Yes, And Tom Shales, for example, was, and may still well be, the critic at the Washington Post. And he said some nasty stuff about me. And that was, my parents lived in that town. So
that's tough.
That did hurt my feelings. Yeah. But he subsequently came around. He said some nice things since then.
You know, you've talked about how you didn't necessarily succeed at Saturday Night Live the way you wanted to. Have you thought about, you know, looking back, what factors caused that? Because I think it's clearly not a lack of comedic talent on your part. So was it not a great fit, or was it the culture of the place, or what do you think, you know, made it so that you couldn't be as successful?
Well, I think it was many things. I was very young and inexperienced. So I have to take some ownership here. I didn't go into that gig with like a big bag of characters and accents and stuff that I could sort of pull out. I had this somewhat foolish idea that people would write for me because I was in the cast. So they'll write me sketches and then I'll, but it didn't quite work like that. And so I came into it very green. It was an incredibly misogynistic, drug-addled atmosphere. And it was really hard for me to navigate.
Yeah. Was there anything that you feel like you would do differently if you could do it again now, you know, knowing what you know now?
Yeah, and I did when I went back to host. And that was the amazing thing. Yeah, when I went back to host, I don't know when it was the first time, it was an incredible experience because I knew what I had decades and decades of experience and I could bring to, now, of course, being a host and being a cast member are two different things. However, there is some overlap here, and I understood what I needed to do in order to make the hosting gig work. And I had a confidence that I absolutely didn't have when I was 21. I can tell you that right now. And the system had, I mean, other things had changed too. It was different producers running the show, and they're running it very competently. It was certainly not a misogynistic, at least to my eye, atmosphere. A lot of very strong, powerful, funny women were there. Tina, Amy, Kristen, all of them, when I was there the first time to host. So it was a very different culture. But I did know, but the schedule and the actual practicality of doing this show, starting on a Monday to that Saturday, has not changed.
Yeah.
And so I knew the protocols and I knew what my agenda had to be.
Oh man, it is so nice to be back. I had a blast hosting last year and wow, things have been going really, really well for me. My show, The New Adventures of Old Christine, is a big fat hit. Thank you. I won the Emmy, which was absolutely fantastic. Do we have a clip? Oh, I brought one. Oh, that's great. Oh, then let's watch it.
That must have been very strange, though, to go back, you know, with a different, totally different power dynamic and so many years later and sort of the, going back to the same thing, but having it feel really different.
Yeah, it really was. Something else, I got to tell. But, you know, when I went back the first time to host, I was the first former female cast member to ever be invited back to host. They hadn't had anyone else.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Wow. That is crazy. I did not realize that. Coming up, we dig into more highlights from Julia's career, including what she really thought about the Seinfeld finale and what working on Veep taught her about the absurdity of American politics.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to our episodes with some of Julia's many co-stars from over the years, like SNL castmate Martin Short, Veep scene partner Tony Hale, and You Hurt My Feelings co-star Michaela Watkins, along with everything else from our free archive. And you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Seinfeld, you know, it seems like from the outside, it was just such a better fit for you comedically and in the sensibility of it than SNL was. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that? And what made it better for you?
Well, first of all, it was written exceptionally well. And it was there was nothing like it on television at the time.
I believe you auditioned for the show with this very quintessential scene about nothing, right? Where it's you and Jerry talking about going out to do something, but you're not hungry, but you'll, you know, go if you don't have to talk.
Come on, let's go do something. I don't want to just sit around here.
Okay.
Want to go get something to eat?
Where do you want to go?
I don't care. I'm not hungry.
You go to one of those cappuccino places, they let you just sit there.
What are we going to do there? Talk?
We can talk.
I'll go if I don't have to talk.
Well, just sit there.
Okay. I gotta check my machine first.
When you read that scene in the audition, what did that tell you about, you know, what this show was going to be and what appealed to you about that particularly?
It told me everything about what the show was going to be. It was very much like Larry David's voice. I knew Larry back from SNL days. I knew that this sort of really weird, quirky writing was something that I understood in my bones. So it felt very natural to me. It felt like me, you know?
Yeah. And then obviously Elaine is not in the pilot, but then you come in that second episode. So what was it like to enter that world as the, you know, you're the only female character on this show of these four people? You know, how did you think about that and your role in the show? Was there a pressure to have a, you know, put that female perspective in the show? Because obviously that was the note that they got after that first episode, that they needed another element in the show.
Right. Well, I never really approached it like, you know, the perspective from my gender per se. I wanted to just play ball with everybody. So I'm not going to lie. In the beginning, I didn't always have a lot to do in certain episodes. And I would go to Larry and Jerry. I would say multiple times and said, hey, you guys, write me more. I need to be in the show more. And that's what I just kept doing. And they did.
Yeah, it's so funny because in the episode about the pilot that they're making, that's basically what happens is they are figuring out, they're realizing that they don't know how to write for a woman. So they kind of were self-aware about that, I think.
Hey, you know, we haven't brought the Elaine character into the show yet. We should try and get her into this scene.
Right. Okay. Elaine enters.
Right.
What does she say?
I don't know. What do women say?
I don't know.
I don't even know what they think. That's why I'm in therapy.
You know, if we bring Elaine in, there's going to be so many people to keep track of. If it's going to be too hard, I forget where everybody's standing. You, me, Kramer, the butler, it's too much.
All right, forget Elaine.
All right.
Right, but then you see they didn't write for me as a woman. They just wrote for me, for this character, as opposed to this, you know, gender, which I think is instructive in a lot of ways from a writing point of view.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Larry David's famous mantra about the show was no hugging, no learning.
Yes.
But I did want to know if you feel like playing Elaine over 9 seasons, did she evolve? Did she change? Or did she really stay the same for you?
I think she evolved. I think she got angrier.
Yeah. How did that manifest for you?
I mean, you know, you have to wonder why these four characters would always hang out together. They're constantly bickering. They're constantly getting into trouble in one way or another, losing money, you know, just it was. There is some line, I can't remember what it was. I cannot keep coming into this apartment. I wish I could remember the line, but it was something I think that Elaine said. It used to make us laugh so much. I wish Jerry was here because I could ask him that. I cannot keep coming into this apartment day after day and something about you with you three morons. But I'm totally butchering it, and it was much funnier than what I just said.
You
two. Oh, I don't want to talk about it.
All right, listen, have you seen my address? Ah, there it is. Okay, I got it. I'll see you later.
Hey, wait a second. Where are you going? I hardly ever see you anymore.
Well, I guess I've been at Reggie's.
The Bizarro coffee shop?
Kevin and his friends are nice people. They do good things. They read.
I read.
Books, Jerry.
Oh. Big deal.
I can't spend the rest of my life coming into this stinking apartment every 10 minutes to pore over the excruciating minutiae of every single daily event.
Why not? Like yesterday, I went to the bank to make a deposit, and the teller gives me this look.
I'll see you later, man. I gotta go.
I like how you say, you know, it's hard to believe that they would keep hanging out together, but they did have the ability within the show to make each other laugh, which was so important, I think.
Totally.
So that could tell you why they would, you know, continue to stick together.
And we as actors had a ball together.
Yeah. And also, like, who else would hang out with these people? So maybe they needed each other.
Yeah, really. They were complete misfits.
I have to ask you about this. I interviewed Larry Charles years ago, and he was telling me the story about the script he wrote about Elaine buying a gun. Do you know about this?
Yeah.
That he wrote the script, and then that's basically why he left the show, is that the studio rejected the idea. Did you ever see that script?
Yeah, we did a table read of it.
What do you remember about it?
I remember it didn't get a lot of laughs.
Oh, okay. So that may have been more of the reason than the subject matter.
I love Larry Charles, don't misunderstand, but that script felt a little dark.
Yeah, out of place for the show. too dark than it was ready to go at that time. Maybe it got a little darker towards the end. I don't know.
Maybe, but I think it was beyond, out of people's comfort zones. And that's saying something on that show.
The finale, obviously, you know, very divisive. I love this, the moment that you did on the final, David Letterman's final show, where you came out in the top 10 and said that line about, you know, taking part in another hugely disappointing series finale with Jerry standing right behind you. And he just did the perfect, you know, they did the perfect cut to him and his reaction.
Thanks for letting me take part in another hugely disappointing series finale.
It feels like the finale in a show like that is kind of just a no-win situation. Like, you can't please everybody, and that's just what it is. What did you, you know, actually think of it at the time, you know, when you were doing it? Were you happy with the way that this show ended?
Well, it was, I will say that just from a purely from an emotional point of view, it was really a delight to sit there in that courtroom and watch one guest actor after another.
That must have been
parade
fun.
Through. I mean, it's like we were watching the show. And so there was, that was really fun. That aspect of it. But I understood why people were disappointed. I mean, first of all, expectations were ridiculous. But I also understood, because we didn't do too much in it. You know, once we were, once we'd been arrested and in court, you know, it was just, it was exactly as I say, it was just us sitting there watching these one person after another parade through.
Yeah. I assume Jerry knew that you were going to make that joke on Letterman. That wasn't a genuine surprise reaction from him.
Of course. Yes.
I love that, though. In fact,
there was a different joke that the Letterman writers had written for me to say. And I was arguing with them about it because I didn't want to say it because I didn't think it was funny enough. And then they pulled out sort of a list of alternative jokes, and this was on it.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And both Jerry and I were like, that one.
I'm glad you stepped in on that.
Yeah.
So Veep, you know, is another incredible show, obviously. Some other Seinfeld alums were involved in it, but it's so different from Seinfeld in a lot of ways.
Yes.
What were the sort of biggest differences for you, you know, making Seinfeld and making Veep? You're obviously at the center of the show, but then just the way that the production went about it.
Totally different experience. I mean, it was an ensemble for sure. But I did produce it. It was single camera. We shot on location. It was a completely different, style, brand of comedy. It was, and I don't mean to imply better or worse, just it was its own thing, I think. Like Seinfeld was its own thing. It had a different tone, and once again, it was a sheer delight to do, albeit incredibly challenging, because it was
longer days than Seinfeld.
Yeah,
yeah. Those old style sitcoms were probably an easier gig in some ways.
Mm. Well, maybe. I mean, I think for the writers, it's just always hard, but in the single camera world, you know, I mean, it was just, and also, you know, those the Veep shows, you know, they would cut together and we, whatever they are, 28, 29 minutes on HBO. Well, in point of fact, each episode was probably 55 minutes and we had to crunch it down. So it took a lot to get that very snappy pace. You know, it had a different pace to it.
After the episode where Selena's mother dies and you do that, you know, insane laugh moment, David Mandel told the Daily Beast, actually, that you were, quote, the only human on Earth who could have played that.
What's going on? What's everyone cheering about? Is Mima better?
Catherine, I thought you were here.
No, I went to get coffee. I asked you if you wanted anything.
No, I didn't hear you say that.
Wait, she's gone? You pulled the plug without me?
It wasn't a plug. It was a ventilator tube that they just... Ooh.
Oh, darling. Oh, honey. No. Mima didn't know you weren't here, honey. She's brain dead. Baby doll, she was brain dead.
We got good news.
about Nevada.
Wait, what?
We got good news from Nevada.
Mom? I'm gonna step outside.
Okay.
So I was wondering, from your perspective, what do you remember about that moment?
I remember that it came to me as we were shooting it, and I put my foot on the gas. I just kept doing it because it was making, it was also, it was so outrageous what was happening. And I got a huge kick out of that moment, I have to say.
So there was an element of genuine laughter on your part at the situation?
Yeah, genuine, yes. And I knew I sort of fell into it, and then I realized it was working, and I just, like I say, I put my foot on the gas.
I think that's one of many moments that really exemplify Selena's profound narcissism. I was listening to your podcast, and you talk about how you call your father a very, you know, deep narcissist. And I was wondering if you ever made that connection while playing Selena. To your own life and sort of, you know, the relation, the, you know, there's a mother-daughter relationship on Veep, and then maybe your own relationship in that way.
I hadn't thought of it like that. I mean, because my dad, yes, he was a narcissist, but he was also a really charming one and incredibly intelligent.
something Selena is lacking.
Exactly. And very charismatic. For me, I think it was, in terms of playing Selena, it was more like, how can I say this? The parallels, I could understand her nastiness and her bitter frustration and her rabid ambition. DC is not a kind place to women. And frankly, the parallels between the political world and show business, they exist. So there was plenty to sort of tap into in that sense, you know?
Can you talk more about those parallels between, you know, the political world and the entertainment world?
Well, sure. I mean, like in entertainment, you're selling, if you're an actor or celebrity or whatever, you're selling yourself. Your brand is you. And you're trying to stay relevant, you know, you want to keep working. I want to keep working. I don't want to get voted out next election.
Yeah.
And this is true of people in DC as well. They're selling themselves. They're trying to appeal to the masses. It's very confusing, perhaps you could say, to be a woman mm-hmm. under those circumstances in both instances.
Do you feel like those feelings have made you more cautious about, you know, what you say and those kinds of things? Like, do you worry about any of that kind of stuff in terms of, you know, saying the wrong thing? Or because that's a, you know, a lot of politicians are like that. And then of course there are politicians like Trump who go the entire opposite direction and you know, and succeed that way. So how do you think about that?
Well, I mean, me personally, I think I know how to edit my thoughts well in conversation. I don't live in fear of me saying the wrong thing. You know, cut to now, I'm going to say something that is abhorrent. but the idea of trying to straddle a conversation or controversy and have it both ways, or say something but not saying it, I think for me, I'm thinking about this in the political world, for me that's comedically that is just yummy. Let's completely lean into that, because I could do that all day long.
My fellow Americans,
Words have many meanings, and sometimes instead of conveying our meaning, they can suggest other meanings and be open to misinterpretation. And because words have many meanings, and what we mean to say when we speak those words can mean so many different things, we can confuse our own meaning and misspeak. We've all done it. It happens to the best of us. Well, yesterday, it happened to me, folks, in a private moment that, unbeknownst to me, was surreptitiously and illegitimately recorded. I misspoke. I'd like now to clarify that misspeaking. I did not and never would mean what some people have inferred I meant when I used the words I accidentally chose in that offhand moment. I meant to speak purely factually and to imply no inherent criticism of any nature.
Yeah, and that kind of speaks to the conversation that's happened for a long time about Veep and how reality outpaced it. And
yeah,
you know, there was a level of awkwardness or cringe, shame situation that then felt like it no longer existed in politics. So it didn't mean the same thing as what you were trying to put forward on Veep.
Yeah, he really, that administration and Trump specifically was doing a better version of our show, but it was not a funny version. It was a tragic version and continues to be tragic.
Definitely. So what we want to do at the end here is our segment called The First Laugh. So I'm just going to run through a few of these questions about firsts in your career in comedy. Mm. And starting with childhood, do you remember the first piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard as a kid growing up?
Yes. Soupy Sales. There was a show called Soupy Sales when I was a little girl. And he made me laugh, and so did Captain Kangaroo. I think it was either Captain Kangaroo or Soupy Sales when ping pong balls would fall down on them, and it would always be a surprise. I mean, it's sort of like a Jack in the Box kind of a joke. You know, it was like, and ping pong balls. And I remember howling laughing over that. I can't say that joke's going to stand the test of time.
It worked for you then, though.
Yeah, it worked for me then.
Do you remember the first time that you knew that you were funny, that you had the ability to make other people laugh?
Probably when I put some raisins up my nose when I was about 3 or 4.
That did it.
Yeah, to make my mom laugh, and she did. And then I inhaled the raisins, and we had to go to the emergency room, get them out of my nose, of my nasal cavity.
Do you have an audition story that stands out in your memory, either because it didn't go well, maybe something that you wanted but didn't get, but that you remember now? For how it went.
I remember I auditioned for a musical. This is back during SNL days. And there was a musical, I do not remember the name of it, but it was going to be like off-Broadway. So it was a big deal. And I had to come in and sing. And then I had to do a dramatic scene afterwards. And first I sang, and I got completely flummoxed and got sort of stage fright and couldn't sing and couldn't almost hear my own voice. And it was just like an utter disaster. And I was so upset that it had gone so badly that in the scene in which it was a speaking scene after that was a dramatic scene, I wept through the entire thing. But it was only because my singing had been so bad. And I remember that the casting director called my agent and said, I'm not sure she has the vocal chops, but her performance in the scene was like, I mean, it was performance ready. Let's put it that way.
Her ability to cry was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the first time you met one of your comedy heroes, someone who you just really look up to in the comedy world, and what it was like to meet them for the first time?
Yes. I mean, I remember I did hanging out with Mary Tyler Moore, and we were actually doing a photo shoot. I'm going to say it was maybe for Entertainment Weekly or something. And I was so smitten to be with her, of course. And the photographer asked us to stand together. In fact, I think the photo made it. I think you can probably find it. To stand sort of close together and put our palms together. And we did that. And just the fact of my hand touching hers just completely gutted me. I was so overcome. Yeah.
Finally, Is there a story or memory from your career that makes you laugh now, but really was not funny when it happened?
Yeah, there is a story, but it wasn't that it wasn't funny, it just wasn't usable. So this is on, this was during Seinfeld days, and I don't remember what the scene was, but I was in a scene with Michael Richards, and I believe Jerry was in the scene, and our wonderful director, Andy Ackerman. We'd shot the scene once or twice, and it was like a three shot, you know what I mean? So it was like the three of us sort of lined up, and maybe the camera would be just like maybe to my waist or, you know, just at the chest level, right? So it wasn't full body. And Andy gave Michael the direction on the next take to make it broader, make it bigger. No, he's talking Michael Richards, you know, what? So already, you know, and we roll camera, we start the scene, and all of a sudden, Michael goes down to the ground, gets on his hands, like he was doing a handstand, and starts doing donkey kicks in the air. And so these feet would just keep coming into the frame like this. It made no sense. It was one of the funniest things I have ever experienced. And we didn't use it, but it was really funny.
That's great. Well, Julia, thank you so much for talking with me today. And I think the new movie is really fantastic. So I think everyone's going to really enjoy it. And
I hope so.
Congrats on everything. It's been just a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise. Thank you so much. Pleasure to talk to you, too. And go see the movie.
All right. Thanks to Julia Louis-Dreyfus and to all of you for listening. If you haven't seen You Hurt My Feelings, the film is available to rent on all of the major streaming platforms right now, so please do check it out. It deserves all of the love in the world and is very much worth your time. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next week on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.